Are your voting rights being threatened? The federal government protects them under the 15th Amendment, but many states are challenging the status quo. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, the Evansville Bar Association highlights this hot topic in its Constitution Day article. My guest is the Honorable Les Shively, Chief Judge of the Vandenberg County Superior Court. We'll look at the history of voting rights, new legislation pending in Congress, and why every vote should count. We'll also tackle this contentious political climate and how you can agree to disagree, recalling Les Shively's debates with his TV sparring partner, Pat Shoulders. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Of course, voting rights, a hot topic right now. After a contentious presidential election, we've seen a push on the state level to alter existing voting laws, leading critics to claim these changes are targeting certain groups and restricting the public's right to choose their elected leaders. In September, the nation commemorates Constitution Day, and each year, the Evansville Bar Association releases an article focusing on one or more aspects of the Constitution. This year, the bar looks at the 15th Amendment, which prohibits the federal government and each state from denying certain voting rights. Here to help us make sense of what's going on and the history of the 15th Amendment is the Chief Judge of the Vandenberg Superior Court, the Honorable Les Shively. Judge Shively, welcome to 2 Main Street. The 15th Amendment, of course, dates back to the end of the Civil War.
That's correct, but that is not really the starting place. The manner in which people vote and the conduct of elections is set forth in the Constitution and is vested with the states. And if you don't mind, let me read this very short part.
Yeah, we have the copy of the Constitution right there here, courtesy of the Bar Association.
This is Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution. It says, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators, representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as to the place of choosing senators. Congress shall assemble at least once," and it goes on how often Congress should meet. The bottom line, that was again, the Constitution was to balance state rights and a strong central government, and so they gave the states the right initially to set up voting procedures. However, they reserved to the federal government to intervene when necessary. And basically, the 15th Amendment was the first time the federal government did that, to recognize the end of the Civil War and giving African Americans the right to vote.
In the article written by the editorial board of the Evansville Bar Association, it's noted, despite the passage of the 15th Amendment, Southern states were able to skirt, kind of avoid the amendment with poll taxes, literacy tests, violence, and intimidation. So even though we had the 15th Amendment, not everybody was getting their rights.
Not everybody was on board.
Right.
And the states relied upon that provision of the Constitution I just read to you and basically instituted things like, you know, the Jim Crow laws, literacy tests, things of that nature. And remember, the 15th Amendment was passed in 1870, I believe. Mm-hmm. But all these things that were happening in these southern states kept on happening. And basically, African-American voters were disenfranchised until the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Voters' Rights Act of 1965. Can you imagine? Almost 100 years before we really gave teeth to the 15th Amendment.
So the states were ruling.
They run the show,
Definitely. Now, there's been some recent Supreme Court cases, Shelby County v. Holder, Brinovich versus Democratic National Committee, and the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Amendment Act is strengthening the Voting Rights Act of 1965, weakened by those two decisions. That's kind of confusing.
It is. Let's talk about Shelby County for a moment.
Yeah, let's explain that.
The Voters' Rights Act of 1965 had a provision that said those states where the less than 50% of the African-American population voted, and those states which had the Jim Crow laws prior to the law in 1965, anytime they want to change their voting laws or procedures, they first must go through the Justice Department to have those changes reviewed to see if they're constitutional and consistent with the 15th Amendment. And that was the oversight provision built into the 15th Amendment, which made sense. I mean, let's face it, the states ruled the roost for almost 100 years, even though the 15th Amendment had been passed. The only thing that really gave it teeth was the Act of 1965. What Shelby County did...
And that's in Alabama?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The county sued the federal government and said, wait a second. We have had those kind of laws around here for 40 years. This state is in full compliance with the Voters' Rights Act and all other federal legislation dealing with voters' rights. We haven't administered a literacy test since years ago, and this provision is no longer relevant. Well, the Supreme Court said, you're right. It was a 5-4 decision. The court said, yeah, that's really no longer relevant, and basically held at that provision of the act that required those targeted states to have their changes in their laws reviewed by the Justice Department was no longer constitutional. And that's the thing that got everybody in a tizzy. That decision was passed and was handed down in 2013, so it's been with us for a few years.
Mm-hmm. So another victory for states' rights.
A big victory for states' rights. Mm-hmm.
Now, what about this? Is it Brnovich?
Brnovich. By the way, I think I read this not too long ago. He was the attorney general at the time of this lawsuit, and now he's running for Senate in the state of Arizona. So we'll see what happens mm-hmm. with that. All right, what this case did two things. Arizona passed state election laws that made several changes. The two biggies that were of concern to the Democratic Party were, number one, it was a crime for anyone other than voting officials to gather and harvest ballots, like absentee ballots or whatever. You couldn't have, you know, your ward healers go out and gather applications for absentee or even ballots under the Arizona law. The other thing the Arizona law did, if you voted in a precinct that you were not registered in, you vote out of your precinct by accident. It doesn't matter if it was intentional or by accident. That vote would not count. And the plaintiff in this case said, wait a second, those provisions are having an impact of disenfranchising minorities. And what the court said was, you know, it's not plain on its face that these laws have that effect. It's your burden to establish a discriminatory impact. And that not being found in the record, the court found those state laws of Arizona to be constitutional.
Now, does the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Amendment Advancement Act, would that reverse those two decisions?
Well, you got to look at, there are two acts. Let's see.
There's a Freedom to Vote Act, too.
The Freedom to Vote Act, which basically addresses what occurred in the Alabama case.
Okay.
And then the other, John R. Lewis goes in and basically tries to tighten up and expand the Voters' Rights Act of 1965.
Okay.
Both of them are stalled in Congress right now.
Right, yeah. Now, I read where the Freedom to Vote Act did pass the House
right.
in the spring. Now, each state under that would be required to have an automatic voter registration. Election Day would become a federal holiday, and it would restore federal voting rights to those who have been released from prison after serving their sentences. And also, I found that was interesting, the Freedom to Vote Act makes it easier for judges to strike down voting maps that unfairly favor one political party over another and denies communities of color fair representation. Now, that would be federal courts, right?
Well, state or federal courts.
Okay, so could you possibly be involved in that?
Possibly. I don't think it'd be a very strategic move by the plaintiffs in those cases because it's a question whether a court sitting in Vandenberg County, that their decision would have application to the entire state. A federal court would make more sense. It's going to be interesting. You know, we just went through the redistricting process here in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And I believe I'm correct, there's a special session of the Indiana General Assembly next week to officially approve those new districts. What I've read, they haven't really changed that much. But it'll be interesting to see if there are any legal challenges.
Well, I haven't heard really a firestorm over this that much.
They really haven't changed the districts that much. What they have done, which I think is a good thing, I think both Democrats and Republicans would welcome this, they've eliminated a lot of these strange districts. There's more continuity, more logic, shall we say. I remember one time the 8th district, congressional district, went all the way up to
Vermilion County.
Vermilion County,
yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Back when I ran in 1994, I mean, That's a
hike.
It's a hike. So I think basically that I don't think the Democrats are really happy with – I think they're more unhappy, not necessarily with the result, but the lack of time for the public to comment. It moved – once the census data was there, it moved rather quickly. In fact, they just had public hearings last week. Now they're going to – General Assembly convenes in a special session – next week to approve it. I think that was their biggest concern, but the result I don't think is something that, again, people are too excited about. But we'll see.
My guest is Les Shively. He's the chief judge of the Vandenberg Superior Court. We're talking about the annual Constitution Day article from the Evansville Bar Association on the protection of voting rights under the 15th Amendment. So was that topic debated or unanimously approved by the editorial board? Focusing on the 15th Amendment, how that happened?
That really was a pretty easy sell to the members of the committee. And the thing that I kind of brought it up, and I think everybody agreed, what's going on right now in this country, this real tension following the 2020 election. And the tension is the states are moving a lot quicker than the federal government, changing their election laws. I think, 38 states have done major overhauls of their election laws. And unlike Indiana, some of these state legislators, they meet year-round. So they can move a lot quicker, especially in those states where they have supermajorities like Indiana. And so now the federal government wants to step in and blunt the impact of these state laws. And they have the power to do that constitutionally. In the provision I just read to you from the Constitution, federal government can step in when they claim it's necessary to do so. Notwithstanding that fact, if the pending legislation at the federal level passes and the president signs it into law, which I'm sure he will do, that law will be challenged in the courts. I think ultimately the constitutionality of these federal laws will come before the Supreme Court.
And what's driving, I think, these states to look at their voting laws are these cries of voter fraud.
Yeah, I think it's
and
a lot of it.
That hasn't really been proven, I think, at least to the majority of Americans. Your comments.
I think that's a fair comment. I think that those that are accused of, well, let's put it this way, they have been in the forefront of these new laws at the state level. And the retort being, well, you know, there really wasn't any election fraud out there. So basically, you're passing legislation for a problem that doesn't exist. The comeback on that is, let's be more prophylactic. Let's get it done now when we don't so we don't have any problems. And this is a, I'll be very careful here to give a personal comment, but unsolicited mail-in ballots is problematic. And I think the states, in my opinion, are well within their rights to address those that issue. And we'll see where that goes.
Now, of course, the Election Commission would investigate any voter fraud.
Right.
And have you seen any voter fraud in this area?
You know, we have a really good election board, and this is as a result of the structure of local government under our Indiana Constitution. But our election board is comprised of a representative from each party plus the county clerk. So if the county clerk is of the party, one of the other members, it's a 2-1 majority technically. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I found, I used to be on the election board. I used to be the attorney for the election board. And during all those years, I really didn't see the election board acting in a very partisan manner. In fact, they were really focused on getting the job done and making the system work. And I recall I was on that board when, remember we had the punch cards?
Oh, yes.
Because of what happened in the 2000 election, federal law was passed that basically we had to eliminate the punch card system and go to we had several alternatives under federal law that would have to be approved and implement those mechanics, if you will. And I remember Betty Knight Smith and I going to the county commissioners and explain this problem, and both of us testifying before that commission that these punch cards was a horrible situation. During a given election day, you'd have maybe 19 different people touch those ballots. It was not secure. It was not the proper way to conduct the election. And she and I worked together and pushed the county commissioners to do what was necessary to comply with the federal law and put in a new system, which was the forerunner of what we have today.
Was that the hanging Chad debate?
Hanging Chad. And this is amazing. You look back into 2000, and that year, no one was talking about being disenfranchised due to race. That wasn't even in the discussion. The whole focus was the mechanics of conducting elections, which led to the system we have now and the computerized ballot approach. So,
now, coming up, we're going to learn more about my guest, the Honorable Les Shively. Has COVID-19 affected his courtroom? Also, we're going to find out about the importance of voting. Every vote counts. Of course, there have been some very close elections. One, of course, in the 8th Congressional District, the famous McIntyre-McCluskey election. And can opposing political views be civil? We saw it right here on WNIN when Shively faced off against Pat Shoulders. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is the Honorable Les Shively, Chief Judge of the Vandenberg Superior Court. We've been talking about voting rights under the 15th Amendment of the Constitution and proposed legislation to protect those rights. It's September, and the Constitution Day article from the Evansville Bar Association details the 15th Amendment. I know in that article, a Columbia University professor and historian Eric Forner is quoted there saying it's a remarkable accomplishment given that slavery was such a dominant institution before the Civil War, and this amendment came out right after the Civil War. And The United States at that time still reeling from the bloody Civil War. Right. Tensions very high.
Exactly. And following the Civil War, we were going through Reconstruction. And again, I noted this earlier, the 15th Amendment was passed in 1870, but the Southern states still looked the other way, ignored it for all intents and purposes, enacted these state laws, literacy tests, things of that nature. And it wasn't until 1965 that all those things were addressed in federal legislation. It took a long time to finally get things going in the right direction.
President Grant, I think, was president when the when the 15th Amendment was enacted. Of course, he was led the Union forces to defeat the South.
Right.
Now, the Bar Association article concludes there has been much progress on improving American voting rights since the 15th Amendment was ratified, and that improvement has involved the legal and political process extensively. I think that's an understatement.
Yeah, and there's so many aspects to voting rights. Number one, we talked about redistricting, making the vote count. Mm-hmm. I mean, if your vote is really diluted because the way a district is configured, that's a concern. Registering to vote. Remember the motor voter law was passed several years ago? Registering to vote was not necessarily that easy. Now every time you renew your license, you can register to vote. The manner in which we tabulate ballots. Again, the curse of the hanging chads from Florida and the 2000
Bush Gore.
So there's so many aspects to it. And people don't like to admit this, but at the end of the day, it comes down to the courts to interpret the laws, both state and federal, in seeing that the system works.
Now, I think you would agree that voting in the U.S. is an ever-evolving process.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, every vote does count. We've had some close races. I mentioned earlier the 8th District Congressional race, the Bloody 8th.
Bloody 8th.
Democrat Frank McCluskey and Republican Rick McIntyre. And, boy, that took months to decide.
It sure did. In fact, if I recall, Rick McIntyre actually showed up at the House orientation session and literally took his seat in the Great Hall.
Yeah, I know he was in the photo op with all the other Republicans.
Exactly.
We're talking about COVID-19 now.
Right.
And you were inaugurated on New Year's Day via Zoom.
That's correct. That is correct. That's kind of a weird situation.
It was.
My colleague, Judge Kiley, I think, administered the oath, and it was very strange.
And how many people were involved in this Zoom call?
I have no idea.
You were like Hollywood Squares, I think.
Oh, I know. Yeah, or the Brady Bunch. Remember that TV show used to.
Right. Now, we were talking earlier that, of course, we're talking about voting and elections and everything. This is your second term now, isn't it?
Right.
On the Vandenberg.
Second elected term. I initially was appointed by the governor to
Governor Mitch Daniels
to fill the vacancy created by the election of Judge Kiley to the Circuit Court.
Okay.
And then I stood for election in 2014, then again in 2020.
Did you have any opposition?
No, I didn't. I really thought that I would have an opponent in 2014 because I was appointed in January of 2013, didn't take office till March 1st of that year. So it was really a short window. And a lot of times when you have a new person in office, especially one who's been appointed, that's a good time to challenge that person. Mm-hmm. So, but it didn't happen. And in 2020, it didn't happen. So I was fortunate.
But you told me earlier that you did have some election night drama in your past when you ran our primary.
Yeah, 1994, the Republican primary for 8th District House of Representatives, which John Hostetler became the nominee. and was elected and defeated Frank McCloskey. In that year, there were like 12 or 13 candidates. In that year, Republicans, that was the Newt Gingrich year, the contract with America, as my old buddy Pat Shoulders would say, contract on America. But correctly speaking, it was contract with America. And that Republican tidal wave carried over, and they took control of the House.
Mm-hmm. Well, how'd you do in that primary?
Well, I think of all the candidates, I came in third or fourth. But one thing that I did that no one else did on that candidate list, I carried Vandenberg County.
So you did. Very good.
I was glad to have done that.
Okay, now let's talk about COVID-19. How has it affected the judicial calendar, Judge Shively?
Across the state, it's been really tough. Vandenberg County is one of those gems that sticks out that was able to survive. Once we were able to reopen, we were able to use the old National Bank at Vince Plaza for our high-volume courts like misdemeanor, small claims, juvenile court, and we're able to use the Vince Plaza as a staging area for criminal jury trials. So once we opened up, we hit the streets running. And we had, as soon as the Supreme Court would allow us to have jury trials, we did, because we could do it.
You could space people out?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it was a win-win deal because the county was getting COVID money, and I think I'm correct on this number, 2020 was one of the best years financially for the old National Bank at Vince Plaza, because the courts were paying rent to use the facility, and it was a win-win proposition.
Oh, definitely, because all their events were canceled.
They were all canceled, and that staff over there, they were so happy to work with us. And the good news was too, because of that, they didn't have to lay anybody off that worked over there. And again, 2020 was one of their best years in recent memory. So, again, a win-win deal. But there, that is a fortuitous event that took place. But it's an example of the vision that our city leaders had 50 years ago, in having that facility it was the auditorium back in those days. Have that facility in close proximity to the federal courthouse, the state courthouse, the county and city administration, and the school corporate. They're all right there within this hub, and there's probably no other county that's organized, that their physical buildings and such are organized that way. So 50 years later, it proved to be a great advantage.
Just walk over across the street.
There you go.
Okay. Now let's learn more about Judge Les Shively. Where'd you grow up, Les?
Right here. As my dad would say, Heavensville.
Where'd you go to school here?
I went to Harper Grade School and Harrison High School.
Okay. And then your college?
I went to IU Bloomington, and I graduated with a BS in accounting. And then I went on to Indianapolis, the law school there, and at the same time was working on my master's of business administration. So when I graduated in 1980, I had both degrees, my JD and my MBA.
So what directed you into the legal profession then?
You know, I think...
You could have gone into business.
I could have gone into business, but my dad had a lot of lawyer friends.
What did your dad do?
My dad was a real estate broker.
Okay.
He had a lot of lawyer friends, and he knew back, I guess when I was in grade school, I had an interest in the law, and he would introduce me to these lawyers.
Chick?
Yeah, old Chick. And I would spend time in their offices, getting to know them, getting to know what they did. So I had this, from an early age, kind of a desire to practice law. I wasn't really sure I wanted to come back to Evansville immediately. And I had some good offers in the Indianapolis area. But a firm here from Evansville, Johnson, Carroll, and Griffith, made me an offer. And it was actually a better offer than any of the Indianapolis firms had presented. So I came back a little earlier than I thought, and I've been here ever since.
And you've had some great mentors there.
Oh, great mentors. John Carroll, Ed Johnson, and his son, Edward Johnson, Charlie Griffith. Back Charlie and John were both members of the American College of Trial Lawyers, a very prestigious group. These were two lawyers from the same firm that were members of a very exclusive organization that recognized lawyers who had incredible trial techniques and talents. So I had a great start.
And you shared some trivia with me about John Carroll's
Supreme
Court appearance.
Yeah, and this morning I called John's son, Brian, who's still with the firm, and I saw this special on Channel 9.
PBS.
PBS, exactly. Mm-hmm. On Sandra Day O'Connor. And there was a part of that piece talked about her first hearing involving a Midwestern state's controversial laws involving oil and minerals. Well, that was the case that John Carroll took to the United States Supreme Court when my first year I was there with the firm. And so brought back some memories.
And how did that case end up?
I believe it was a 5-4 decision, and Mr. Carroll's clients did not prevail.
Okay. Now, okay, you practiced law.
Yes.
For how long?
About 30-plus years.
Okay. Long legal career here in Evansville.
Right.
And then how did this appointment from Governor Daniels happen Superior Court?
Basically what happened was, after the election of 2012, Judge Kiley was elected as judge of the Vandenberg Circuit Court, and that vacancy was created. And I remember my wife and I were on vacation during the holidays like we usually get out of town during that time. And I had just been interviewed by the governor's staff. And I forget how many people applied. I think maybe there were like 7 or 8, maybe 9 people that applied for that position. And I think it was January 10th in the afternoon, I get a phone call from the governor's office, Governor Daniels' office. And by the way, this is kind of unusual. I really thought that Governor Daniels would defer to Governor-elect Pence to make that call.
Okay.
But Governor Daniels was very insistent, I'm governor until January 19th, and I'm going to make all appointments until then. It was not necessarily the smoothest transition between the two administrations, but that's for another day. So I had this telephone call in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, saying that the governor had appointed me to the bench, but not to tell anybody, because the news release had not gone out yet.
Okay.
So I asked this person who called me, I said, When do I take office? Because I had a booming practice that was going to have to wind down, and I thought I'd at least have 6 months to do something. And the answer was no. They said, well, you work it out with your staff down there. Good luck to you. And you could tell this was an administration getting ready to move out. In fact, you hear the moving vans in the background. But it was kind of an interesting transition, because the then chief judge, Judge Trockman, wanted me to start March 1st. So I had less than 2 months to wind my practice up and start my new job.
Do you remember that? Well, I'm sure you remember that first case.
I do. It was a small claims case.
Uh-huh.
And so much I can say on the air.
No names, of course.
It was a dispute between two former lovers in their middle age, and the man had sued the woman in small claims court, claiming that she had broken into his condominium and stolen a bunch of material. And let's see if I can clean this up.
No, they weren't married.
They weren't married.
Okay, but they were a couple.
They weren't married.
Yes.
And so the man who brought the claim had the burden to prove his case. After all, he called a bunch of witnesses. And at the conclusion of his case, I said, sir, you really haven't given me anything to establish that she broke into your condo. He said, well, I forgot to tell you, the pictures are missing. I said, the pictures are missing. He said, well, these nude photos we had taken together, they were missing, and therefore she's the one that took them. Very convoluted argument, to say the least. And by my first case, I thought, you know, this is not what they prepared me for at judge's school, and hopefully things will pick up after this one.
So you had to keep this this demeanor during this whole thing. Yes, like, oh, yeah, okay. Now, anyway, let's go on another topic here. Your wife, Linda, a travel agent. So obviously you guys like to travel.
That's
how
right.
has COVID-19 affected your travel plans?
Well, you know, Morgan, our son slash grandson, because we've raised him since he was an infant. Since age three, we've done every holiday, Christmas holiday, someplace nice, a vacation. We've been to Europe, we've been to Hawaii, we've been in the Caribbean, the cruises, whatever. Last year was the first year we didn't do that.
Really?
And obviously for good reason.
So you're anxious to get back?
Yes. My wife is probably more anxious than I am.
Yeah, okay. Well, our listeners may recall your TV appearances on the popular WNIN TV program Shively and Shoulders, a lively debate. Pat Shoulders, of course, taking the liberal view, you the conservative bent. A feisty banner, but always civil. Now, coming up on 2 Main Street, we're going to ask Judge Shively about the importance of being able to agree to disagree and the relationship among judges and attorneys. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is the Honorable Les Shively, Chief Judge of the Vandenberg County Superior Court. Every year, the Evansville Bar Association publishes an article in September to mark Constitution Day. This year, the focus is on the 15th Amendment, which protects voting rights in the states. Right now, there's a lot going on as Democrats in Congress want to restore and enhance voting rights, claiming many state legislatures are restricting those rights. The article details the ongoing debate without taking sides, and I think that's the whole idea, is just put the information out there, right, Les?
Exactly. We hope we give enough information to inform the public, but also guide them to where they can get additional information.
Sure, yeah. Now, voting rights caught up in a political firestorm. Is there a fear maybe that voters may be turned off by this rancor on both sides? Is that always a fear, or is that going to fire people up to go to the polls?
I think it's more of a motivator. You know, what's really interesting, I remember when Congress passed the law allowing 18-year-olds to vote, we thought we'd see a sea change in the election process and the people participating. And this young group would be so motivated that they'd show up at the polls in record numbers. It's 2021, and as of 2021, we haven't seen those record numbers yet. So it's hard to gauge what motivates voters. It really is. It usually takes controversy to motivate them to go to the polls. People don't show up to vote for somebody, especially an incumbent, because he's doing such a great job, per se. It's because there's maybe a challenger that has developed a campaign on a particular issue. One of the rules in politics is the fact that you take one or two issues and take them to the bank and drive them hard. And I think that results in a lot of this tension, a lot of this controversy, election time.
Can't we all just get along, learn to agree to disagree? Of course, I remember, and I'm sure many of our listeners remember, the Shively Shoulders face-off on WNIN Channel 9. You and Pat Shoulders on different sides of the aisle. But a very civil debate. Is that still happening locally?
Well, I don't know if it's happening locally, because my job right now requires that I not get involved in partisan issues.
But you are a political observer, though.
I think, and one thing I learned in this COVID situation is how well the courts, the county government, and the city government work together. We are all on the same page, Republicans and Democrats and independents like myself, because we're not, judges in this county don't run on a partisan basis.
Yeah, nonpartisan.
And you look at, for example, the county commissioners right now, it's two Democrats, one Republican. Yeah, you see very little dissension. We have a mayor who's been very popular, low these many years, and been able to accomplish a lot legislatively through the city council, and yet his party has never controlled the city council the entire time he's been mayor. So, and one thing Pat and I also observed, we would start our show off talking about issues, starting at the national level, state and local. And one of the things that we learned by doing that exercise was that at the national state level, we argued back and forth. As we got local, we were most times on the same page.
Right.
And I think we've seen a lot of that in this community.
Now, of course, was it your last appearance, the 2020 election preview? Was that your last Shoulder Shively?
Yes, it was.
Deal?
I think it was.
Yeah, and that was done remotely.
From here.
From here at the studios.
Right.
Channel 9. And I know you were predicting the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Did you predict Trump's victory?
Probably did.
Mm-hmm.
Probably did.
Mm-hmm. And I know you predicted that Vandenberg County would go for Donald Trump.
That's probably an easy call. But
So any more? You guys still communicate regularly?
Not as regular as we used to. Really don't. My nephew is a partner in his law firm now, so my nephew keeps me up to date in terms of Pat's activities, but we really haven't had a good sit down in a long time.
Now, when that show was really on fire, and it was a must-see TV. That was some great television.
Well,
you guys were really good. What was the reaction then to your show? When you got off the air, did people comment on what you're talking about? Did you get much feedback?
Our last show was sometime in December of 2008. And so how many years ago has that been? 13 years ago,
yeah, right?
There's not a week that goes by that some stranger, either in the courthouse or someplace, says, "Hey, aren't you that guy that did that TV show? What was it called? Shively and somebody." Anyway, it's just amazing. 13 years still people come up and talk to me about the show. So,
and I think the legacy of that show is the educational value of that show. I mean, you learned a lot watching you guys. And
well,
you learned from each other.
We did. Of course, Pat didn't learn anything because he never prepared for the show. I always had to give him information. So it was tough. Both of us had fun doing that. And we had our own sources of information. And we embraced different kinds of guests. And we had national, state, and local guests. We also did the live phone situation. Telephone calls came in. And that was an educational thing for all of us.
Did you have a delay switch?
Well, we told people we did. I don't think we really ever implemented it. Hope I'm not getting anybody here in trouble, but...
But did you have any problems with that?
We never did. In fact, the one evening I was concerned, if you recall, the sex scandal in the Catholic Church was a big issue. in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And Bishop Gettelfinger agreed to come on our program for the entire hour. He had just come back from the National Bishops Conference in Dallas, where this issue was at the forefront. And our show started, back at 7 o'clock in the evening. People started calling in to be on the air at 5.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I mean, all the phones lit up. And I was concerned that, because this is a very emotional issue. And the bishop, God love him, he sat there, took the calls, gave straight answers, but it was one of the longest hours I can recall.
Now, did Pat Shoulders have some kind of routine before the show started, some kind of music he listened to? Or?
Well, I suppose he was doing something, because he always arrived about 2 seconds before he went on the air. So he's listening to music or doing something.
I know you guys had a great rapport.
You know, but this one reason I think that we had that. We went to the same grade school, same high school, same college, same law school. And I think you, seriously, you know, that we had so many mutual memories, if you will, during our childhood. And I think that tends to create a chemistry, if you will, that worked between these two people. Yeah, I don't think I would have chemistry with anybody else. But we did some commercials with some people, for some companies, and they said, well, this is a 90-second spot. And they said, now, you want us to count you down? We said, no, we know when the 90 seconds are up. And they'd give us the cue, and we'd be done at 89.5. I mean,
wow.
We had great chemistry.
I'm curious. You're a judge now. Pat Shoulders, an attorney. Has he ever been in your courtroom arguing a case?
He hasn't. I'm trying to think.
That would be interesting.
I think there was one case he briefly appeared in about 4 or 5 years ago.
Was that awkward?
No.
Nope.
No, not really. It wasn't awkward. Pat always conducts himself in a very professional manner, and does a good job. But no, it wasn't that awkward.
So what is that relationship now? You're a former attorney. You know the attorneys in town.
Right.
And then they come into your courtroom, and now you're the authority figure.
I tell you one thing, it helps a little bit. Now I'm starting to age myself a little bit here. But a lot of the attorneys that come before me are not necessarily people that I was in practice with. They're younger attorneys. And so there's not that tension, shall we say, hey, used to practice with this person, now I'm in a different role. There's a few attorneys out there where I have that situation, and it's a good relationship. But what helps, I think, in terms of not having to worry about that dichotomy of once being across the aisle from one of the attorneys appearing for me, because a lot of the attorneys basically weren't around during most of my time I was in practice.
A new crop.
And I like that for myself, because the younger lawyers keep me young, keep me sharp, and it's a different atmosphere.
Well, we've been talking about the 15th Amendment. Every vote does count. Make sure you know your rights and what's going on in your state and the community. I know Judge Shively gave me a copy of the U.S. Constitution, and the Bar Association handing these out. That's a good idea. The Evansville Bar Association spreading the message in its latest Constitution Day article on the 15th Amendment. Informed voters do make a difference. Judge Shively, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street.
My pleasure.
2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Now here's a sample of that banter between my guest, Les Shively, and Pat Shoulders. This clip is from their 2020 election preview for the Rotary Club of Evansville.
4 years ago, the polls showed Hillary Clinton ahead. In fact, my comments were at Rotary that she was going to win unless we had a Brexit moment, okay? Remember that little discussion?
Yes.
And we did. Pat, are going to have another Brexit moment and the president will be reelected?
We are not. What we learned 4 years ago, if we had listened carefully, was the Donald Trump insurgency in the Republican Party and the Bernie Sanders insurgency in the Democratic Party was the voice of America crying out, we want no more Bushes, we want no more Clintons, we've done that for 30 years, it is time to have a change. Well, my party nominated a Clinton, yours
nominated a shady businessman and failed TV host,
but he represented change. The difference is we now have an incumbent with a four-year failed record.
Well, you have an incumbent with a four-year record, but if you really stand back and look at the president's record, it's not his record that is really at issue in this election. And I know of all the important and serious things we have going on, this may sound a little funny for me to make this observation, but this is like a high school junior class officers election. People don't like the president, and quite frankly, there's reasons for that. He goes out of his way to insult. And I said this a year ago. There's only one person that can beat Donald Trump, and that's Donald Trump.
4 years ago, he happened to run against a person who may be the only candidate we could have found in the United States of America with equal unfavorability ratings. and it's just a fact. Hillary was unfavorable. You can attribute that to a lot of things. And he squeaked by 77,000 votes in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. That's not going to happen again. First prediction, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris win in a landslide, both popular vote and electoral.
Joe Biden received 306 electoral votes, Donald Trump 232. And Biden won by more than 7 million votes. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.